Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everyone. Okay, so this evening we take sutta number, I think it's 33 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahagopalika Sutta, the greater or larger discourse on the cowherd. And this sutta develops in four sections. The first section, the Buddha gives a simile of an incompetent cowherd. And he explains the incompetent cowherd in terms of 11 factors, 11 ways in which he's incompetent, incapable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. And then the Buddha compares the cowherd like this to a monk who possesses 11 qualities that make him incapable of growth, of progress, and fulfillment in the Dhamma. And the Buddha takes the same 11 expressions that he uses in relation to the cowherd and applies them to the monk, and then he explains them in a way that relates these qualities to the Dhamma and discipline. Okay, so these are two sections. The simile of the incompetent cowherd, and then its application to the incompetent monk, the badly disciplined, badly trained monk. Okay, and then this is followed in paragraph 15, the Buddha introduces 11 qualities. These are the opposite qualities, possessing which a cowherd is capable of taking care of a herd of cattle. And these 11 qualities are exactly the opposite of the qualities that make the cowherd incompetent. And then the Buddha takes these 11 qualities, the same terms, the same expressions, and he applies them to describe a monk who is capable of growth and progress in this Dhamma and discipline. So he uses it. This is in paragraph 16. And then in the rest of the sutta, the Buddha explains the meaning of these 11 expressions in relation to the monk, to the qualified, the well-qualified monk. So what I'm going to do is to skip over the negative part of the sutta. We don't need guidance in how to be a bad cowherd or how to be a bad practitioner, but instead we take the qualities that are distinctive of the competent, capable cowherd, and then we see how the Buddha applies these to describe the well-disciplined, properly trained monk. Okay, so I'll go straight into paragraph number 15, where the Buddha sets out to explain how a cowherd possesses 11 factors, 11 qualities, which makes him capable of keeping and rearing a herd of cattle. And what often strikes me is something very impressive in many suttas is the way the Buddha develops similes, presents a simile and then develops it in sometimes rather complex ways. And this is a quality of the Buddha that continually amazes me, because it's said, according to the traditional account, that he grew up living a sheltered life in the palace, had very little exposure to the outside world. Okay, somewhat like I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. I know nothing about looking after a herd of cattle. Yet if you ask me, what are the qualities needed to look after a herd of cattle? I would say, one has to wear a cowboy hat, ride a horse, and know where they should go to feed. That's it. Okay, but the Buddha seems to know in such detail so many different aspects about everyday life, ordinary life, in so many different domains. For example, in other sutta, he might describe the qualities that a goldsmith has in properly preparing the gold metal, properly preparing it in order to make ornaments out of it. In another sutta, he might describe the qualities of an elephant trainer, the steps that he has to fulfill in order to properly train an elephant. Another sutta, he might describe the qualities a woodcutter might have in order to prepare a block of wood for making articles of furniture. And so there are so many different similes from ordinary everyday life, from different trades, different professions. And these are all, I would say, to my mind, evidence of the great brilliance and comprehensiveness of the Buddha's, we can't say higher wisdom, but the brilliance and comprehensiveness of the Buddha's understanding of different aspects of life. So here we have 11 factors that a cowherd must possess in order to bring up a herd of cattle. And so the Buddha says that the cowherd has knowledge of form. He is skilled in characteristics. He picks out flies' eggs. Apparently flies settle on the cattle and lay their eggs, perhaps in the hair of the cattle. And so a cowherd has to look at the hair and pick out the eggs. Okay, he must dress wounds. He smokes out the sheds. I don't know why he must smoke out the sheds, but apparently this was the job of a cowherd. He knows the watering place, so he has to lead the cattle there to take water, to drink water. He knows what it is to have drunk. He must know when the cowherds have finished drinking so that he could then lead them away from the drinking place. He knows the proper road for leading the cattle. He is skilled in the pastures. He knows the proper pastures to take the cattle for grazing. He does not milk dry when he's milking the cows. I guess for some reason he doesn't milk them completely dry. Maybe he has to leave some milk for the calves to drink. Or maybe there's an understanding, even when the cows are not bringing up calves, perhaps there's some understanding amongst cowherds that one doesn't completely milk the cow dry. I don't know what the reason might be. And then he shows extra veneration to those bulls who are the fathers and leaders of the herd. It was a good reason why he has to show some special consideration and respect to the bulls. If he doesn't show that respect to them, then they might become angry and start attacking him. My own little bit of wisdom in walking through the forests in Sri Lanka where I was living is that one has to show special veneration to those monkeys who were the chiefs of the troop. Because if you don't show them, especially when one is giving out food, we would give them leftover food. And if one gives the food, one naturally has pity for the smaller, weaker monkeys, and so one is inclined by one's own feeling of compassion to give them the food. But if one gives them the food first, without first giving it to the tough, big, strong monkeys, then the big, strong monkeys, first they get angry at you, and they might attack you, which could be rather dangerous. And in any case, if you give the food first to the little weaker monkeys, then they will go running after the little weaker monkeys and bite them and pummel them with their fists. And so what we have to do is first give the food to the bigger monkeys. Some of them are really tough. You think monkeys are cute, but some of them can be quite violent. So one gives first to the big monkeys, satisfies them, and then when they're preoccupied with their food, then we can give to the little monkeys. Okay, so one shows extra veneration to the bulls who are the fathers and leaders of the herd. Okay, so then when a cowherd possesses these 11 qualities, then he's able to properly look after a herd of cattle. And so the Buddha says, now he applies this, and he says, when a monk possesses these 11 qualities, he's capable of growth, increase or progress and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Okay, what are the 11? Then the Buddha uses almost exactly the same 11 expressions. The one change comes in the last item, where the monk shows extra veneration not to the bulls, but to the elders of long standing, who were the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. Okay, so now the Buddha uses these 11 expressions, which are characteristic of bringing up a herd of cattle. And so the question comes up, how are these to be understood in relation to the training of the monk, or more generally, a training of a practitioner? Okay, so first, the Buddha takes, how does a monk have knowledge of form? Here the key word is rupa. So the word rupa is what we translate as form or material form. Apparently in relation to a cow, it means that the cowherd has to have some knowledge of perhaps the bodily structure of the cow. But now the Buddha uses the word form or rupa as a designation for the first of the five aggregates that constitute the person, the living being. So we have the five aggregates are the aggregate of form, feeling, perception, the mental or volitional formations, and consciousness. And in the process of understanding or investigating the five aggregates, generally one begins with the investigation of material form, bodily form, because the aggregate of bodily form is coarser than the four mental aggregates. And so it's easier to investigate the aggregate of bodily form. Then when one has comprehended and investigated the aggregate of bodily form, then based on that understanding, one could turn the mind to the mental aggregates and investigate feeling, perception, the mental formations, and consciousness. And so when one investigates bodily form, how does one go about investigating it? The most fundamental way of understanding bodily form is to understand it in terms of the four great elements and what is called the material form derived from the four great elements. So what are these four great elements? The four great elements are the earth element, the liquid element, what's also called the water element, the fire element or heat element, and the air element or wind element. Okay, so how does one actually investigate and comprehend the four material elements? First, normally, one has to develop some degree of samadhi or concentration of mind, generally by beginning with something, a simple object, like the mindfulness of breathing, so that the mind becomes focused, collected, the hindrances and disturbing thoughts can be removed. Then one takes this focused, concentrated mind and begins to investigate the four elements within the body itself. And so to investigate the earth element, first one has to understand what is meant by this earth element. The earth element is not just this earth on which we're standing, on which we walk and conduct all of our activities, but the earth element is that particular feature of matter that accounts for its property of solidity. And this aspect of solidity is most clearly manifest in the characteristic of hardness. It's actually said that the earth element spans a continuum or spectrum ranging from hardness to softness. And so both hardness and softness are properties of the earth element. But between the two, the quality that more distinctly represents the earth element is the property of hardness, since it's hardness that represents the solidity of the earth element. And so to investigate the earth element, one can begin by taking some part of the body which is especially hard and solid to get a sense, a felt sense of this quality of hardness. For example, one can click one's teeth together, so one gets some sense of the resistance of the teeth, hardness of the teeth. Or one could actually use one's hands to feel the teeth. The fingernails also provide a good specimen of hardness. Or in parts of the body where there's not much flesh, one could feel the bones beneath the skin. So one gets some feelings, what I call a felt sense of hardness. And then dwell some time on the sense of hardness till the distinctive characteristic of the hardness becomes evident. Okay, then to apply this to actual experience in sitting meditation, one goes through the body, part by part, sensing the hardness in that part of the body. One can begin on a relatively gross level by taking major parts of the body. For example, the head, feel the hardness, the solidity of the head. Then take the neck, shoulders. To bring it out more clearly, one could take each shoulder one at a time. Then the upper arms, lower arms, hands. Then go to the chest, belly. Pubic region, then the legs, each leg, upper leg, lower leg, foot, then up again and then down the back, upper back, lower back, buttocks, okay, and then one moves through part by part, sensing the solidity of each of these parts of the body. And so then one is getting a feel for the earth element in the body. Okay, then as the mind becomes subtler, it takes practice to get familiarized. It's a process of familiarization with the feeling of solidity or hardness in each of these gross parts of the body, the parts that one is taking as a block. But as the mind becomes more familiar with them and more familiar with experiencing the quality, the distinctive quality of hardness or solidity, then one can move the mind through the whole body as a kind of sweeping process. Experiencing the hardness or solidity in the body, going inch by inch, even fraction of an inch by inch, fraction by fraction of an inch through the body, till it's going like the mind is going like a CAT scan through the whole body, experiencing the whole body is made up of, even at the microscopic level, as constituted of the earth element. Okay, then the second element is called the apodatu, which means literally it's the water element. But here by water is not meant just the substance H2O, but it's any kind of liquidity in the body. And so it includes all of the bodily fluids, all the water distributed throughout the whole body, even if it's in parts that are basically solid, like the muscles or the bones, but still the water within those parts is the water element. And it's said that the water element has the special property of cohesion. It's what binds the particles of solid matter together. And it's also said that the water element has the property of flowing or oozing. This comes from direct observation that one could observe. If one spills water, then it flows. But why does the water element have the property of cohesion? It seems that this also came about through observation, particularly in India, where people make their own rotis or chapatis, these are flatbreads, by taking wheat flour, putting the wheat flour into a bowl, and to get the particles of wheat flour to hold together, what do? You have to add water to it. And so it's the water that binds the particles of the wheat flour together and makes them stick into a kind of paste. And then one takes that paste or dough and puts it on the flat pan in order to make the chapati, the flatbread. Okay, and so when one is going to observe the water element, first one has to get a sense in the body. I think it's easier to begin with the property of flowing rather than cohesion. And one can get a sense of things in the body that flow. It just occurred to me that if you get up to urinate, then you get a sense of liquid or something that flows. But normally, if one is sitting meditation, one doesn't want to urinate. And so one can get a sense of the saliva in the mouth. One could move the saliva around in one's mouth and see how it moves. Or if one has very, very subtle mind, one could feel, get some sense of the blood flowing through the blood vessels. Or if one is sweating, one could feel the liquid property of the sweat on the body. And so one gets familiar with this flowing property. Then when one gets acquainted with the flowing property, then one uses the same procedure as with the earth element, going through the body part by part, first at a gross level, feeling, getting a sense of the presence of the liquid within that part of the body. It's rather hard to feel, to get a flowing sensation if one just feels the head, say, or feels the arm. But if one becomes very, very sensitive to these parts of the body, one could get some sense of the presence of liquid in those parts of the body. And as the mind becomes more sensitive, then one gets a sense of the way each of these parts of the body holds together. All of the constituents of these parts of the body are holding together. They're cohering or exhibiting this property of cohesion. And then what is binding everything together is the liquid element. So first one goes part by part until one builds up a momentum. Then when one develops a momentum, then one can move again through the whole body, beginning from the top of the head, sliding down, just attending to the property of, it could be either flowing, or cohesion. If one takes cohesion, one is feeling how the entire body is holding together, even at this micro level, fraction of an inch by fraction of an inch, holding together through the presence of the liquid element, the water element. Okay, then to contemplate the fire element, which has the distinctive quality of heat. And so one can attend to any, initially one can attend to any part of the body in which one could feel the bodily heat, the natural temperature of the body. Or if it's difficult to get a particular place, one could just feel the body as a whole to get a sense of the heat of the body. And then when one gets this felt sense of bodily heat. Then one can apply it first at the gross level, go through the body part by part, head, neck, shoulders, chest, belly, and so on. Stopping there even for a minute, a couple of minutes, to feel the heat in that part of the body. And then after going through the entire body, part by part, and becoming familiar with it by repeated trips or journeys through the whole body, as the heat element becomes more prominent, more easier to discern, then one could start scanning the whole body in terms of the experience of heat in the body at what I call the micro level, so that one could experience inch by inch, fraction of an inch by fraction of an inch, the warmth or heat within the body. Okay, then the fourth element is the air element or wind element. Okay, and so to get some felt sense of the air element, one can begin with something like a process, the process of in and out breathing. But now one is not practicing mindfulness of breathing. One is not trying to be aware of the continuity of the breath, but rather one is observing the process of in and out breathing in order to get some sense of the functioning of the wind element within the body. And it's said that the air element has the characteristic of oscillation or vibration. That's one of its characteristics. Another characteristic is pressure. I think this was based on the observation that, for example, if one fills up a balloon by blowing air into it, then the rubber of the balloon, as it fills up with the air, a pressure is being exerted, and that pressure comes from the air. Okay, so to get some sense of the presence of the wind element in the body or the air element, one can go through each part of the body trying to sense, it could be a sense of the pressure in that part of the body or some sense of vibrations that might be occurring at very subtle levels. But one goes through each part trying to feel within that part either the pressure being exerted, the vibration, or it could be the movement of that part of the body as one is breathing in or in and out. Okay, when one becomes acquainted with, at a gross level, this pressure, this vibration, this movement, this in and out movement, then one can start attending to the body at the very subtle level, sweeping or scanning through the body to experience the pressure, the vibration, the oscillation occurring throughout the whole body. Okay, so in this way, one is understanding the four great elements in the body. And then on the basis of this, one goes into the understanding of the form derived from the great elements. These would be the properties like color, sound, odor, taste, flavor, tactile sensations. And then the matter of the sense faculties, the matter that enables one to sense objects. Okay, so this is how one gains this knowledge of form. And then this knowledge of form, this becomes the gateway to understanding all five aggregates. Okay, next we come to paragraph 18. How is a monk skilled in characteristics? Okay, now the Buddha explains this by reference to a passage that comes in another sutta. It comes in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's sutta, the book of threes in the Anguttara Nikaya, sutta number 2. And this sutta says that a fool is characterized by his actions, a wise person is characterized by his actions. Okay, then the question comes up, how is a fool characterized by his actions? How is a wise person characterized by his actions? The Buddha gives the answer to this by saying that the fool is one who indulges or engages in misconduct of body, speech, and mind. And then the wise person is one who engages in good or virtuous conduct of body, speech, and mind. And so it's not enough to use the labels to characterize people, to designate people, this one is foolish, this one is wise. But in order to find out who is really foolish, who is really wise, one has to inquire into their actions, their conduct. Okay, and so a monk should be skilled in characteristics. When dealing with other people, he should be able to recognize which person is, by means of his actions, is a foolish person, and then should avoid becoming intimate and associating closely with that person. And then he should be able to recognize who is the wise person, observing a person's actions. And then when one finds a wise person, then one associates with that person and becomes intimate with that person. So this is how one is skilled in characteristics. Okay, the third quality is being able to pick out flies' eggs. Now for cows, the flies' eggs are things which are quite harmful, because when the flies' eggs are allowed to remain in the fly, eventually the fly's eggs will mature, and out of the fly's eggs will emerge not flies, but what? Maggots, worms. And then those maggots will look for any wounds in the cow. They'll get into the wound, they'll infect that wound. And then the cow might get sick on account of the infection. And if the sickness is serious, then the cow might even die. And that will be a great loss to the cow herd. Okay, so a similar consideration applies to the training of the mind. It might seem that individual thoughts are not particularly harmful, but if these thoughts are allowed to pass without being recognized, without being removed, then those thoughts can develop a kind of momentum of their own. They can build up force, and they become deeply lodged within the mind. And then they can motivate one to engage in destructive behavior. And also they reinforce the deep latent tendencies of the mind, and so those latent tendencies will remain with one, even going from life to life. And so the training on the Buddha's path is to recognize the unwholesome thoughts and then to remove these thoughts. This is part of the training in Sammasankappa, right thinking, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, and so the Buddha says here that when a thought of sensual desire or sensual craving has arisen, a monk does not tolerate it, does not simply allow that thought to pass by and to sink down deep into the mind. But what's not said is that first he has to recognize it to be able to identify it. And then he has to abandon that thought, remove it, drive it away, and then ultimately at the final stage to annihilate or exterminate it. And then similarly, when a thought of ill will, this can be a thought of anger, a thought of resentment, a thought of hostility has arisen, again, one recognizes it, one does not tolerate it, but one abandons it, removes it. And then when a thought of cruelty, maybe not such a good translation, harmfulness might be better, though this would also include cruelty. This is the thought of harming others, inflicting pain on them. For some reason, this is treated as a distinct type of thought, distinct from ill will. Maybe ill will is just feeling the anger and resentment, but the thought of harming is the actual wish to inflict pain and suffering on others. Okay, so those are the three main types of unwholesome thought or wrong thinking, wrong intention. But then to include all of the many other unwholesome thoughts, the Buddha says when evil or bad, unwholesome states, any kind of state of mind arises, one recognizes it, does not tolerate it, but abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. And so to remove these unwholesome thoughts, the Buddha has taught various remedies or antidotes, particularly to remove the thought of sensual desire, sensual craving. The direct antidote to that is the meditation on what's called the impure or unattractive nature of the body. That is, investigating the body as a compound of some 30, or a collection of some 32 disagreeable, unattractive parts. So when one examines the body in terms of these individual parts, one sees that each of these parts taken individually is not beautiful, not really tantalizing and attractive. And then when one puts them all together into the whole body, then one asks, how can the whole body be attractive? It's just a superficial image or appearance that one is seizing upon. This is called the nimitta, the sign that one is grasping upon. But when one investigates beneath the sign, then the thought of sensual desire subsides. The antidote for ill will and resentment is the thought of loving kindness. And then the antidote to the thought of harming or cruelty is compassion. When one feels empathy with others, with the suffering of others, then one experiences their suffering so deeply within one's own heart that the very idea of inflicting suffering upon others cannot get a grip in the mind. Okay, so practicing in this way, that is how one picks out fly's eggs. Okay, next one comes, how does the monk dress wounds? Okay, now, when the cow gets a wound, then there's a tendency for that wound to become infected, and then from the infection, various types of fluids can flow out. And so the cowherd, when he's looking after the cow, he has to know how to wash the wound, to remove those substances from the body that are flowing out, and then to put a proper medication on the wound, and then to dress the wound so that it's not exposed to flies and to insects. And so the key idea here, I think, is to prevent some kind of repulsive substance from flowing out. Okay, so when we apply this to the training of the monk, the Buddha explains that on seeing a form with the eye, the monk does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil or bad, unwholesome states of covetousness, that's craving, and grief, here I would take the grief to be dejection, unhappiness, might invade him. And so he practices the way of its restraint, the way of restraining the eye faculty, guarding the eye faculty, and then achieving restraint over the eye faculty. Okay, now just as the cowherd, when treating the wounds, doesn't want to allow any kind of infection to set in with the wound, and then he wants to clear out the pus and blood that's flowing out of the wound, so what the monk in training wants to do is to prevent these qualities of covetousness, it's craving and grief or dejection, from flowing into the mind. The word here that's translated invade actually comes from a root which means to flow. And so this seems to connect the training and sense restraint with the idea of taking care of the wounds. One wants to prevent something which is defiling or corrupting from flowing. And one begins the process of sense restraint by guarding the senses so that the senses don't grasp at the signs of attractive or repulsive objects. Because it's when one grasps upon the appearance of what's attractive, that the states of craving arise. And if one grasps upon the signs or appearances of what's repulsive or what's threatening, that states of dejection or displeasure, anger or resentment might arise. Okay, the signs and features, these two terms are distinguished in that the sign is the general feature of an object, let's say, the general appearance of an object, while the features are the detailed characteristics of an object. Okay, so when exercising sense restraint through the eye, for example, okay, one of the main defilements that the monk has to be on the guard against is sensual craving or sensual desire. And this will generally arise first if one has encounter with a member of the opposite sex. There'll come the grasping at the general sign, general appearance. Ah, that's a beautiful girl. So there comes the general, a grasping at the general sign. Then, if one isn't attentive, isn't vigilant, then the sense faculty naturally will start looking at particular qualities. Lovely hair, nice smile, pretty eyes. And so, as one looks at the particular features, then that causes the desire or craving to increase and become more differentiated, more widely distributed. Okay, so instead of simply grasping at the sign or features, one has to bring awareness or mindfulness to the situation. Which doesn't mean that one cuts oneself off from any kind of sense contact with the object, but one maintains a kind of vigilance, especially over one's own mind, so that the mind doesn't just go out and grasp at the object. Okay, and so one exercises this attentiveness, this sense restraint, seeing a form with the eyes, hearing a sound with the ear, smelling an odor with the nose, tasting a flavor with the tongue, touching a tactile sensation with the body, and then most important is cognizing a mental object with the mind. Because all the time, many different mental objects are continually flowing through the stream of the mind, or continually flowing through the mind, or in a steady stream. And this flow of mental objects is occurring very, very quickly. So much so that we're usually not even aware of the multiplicity and diversity of objects that's flowing through the mind. But occasionally, some mind object will arise which is particularly prominent. And then if one is not attentive, not vigilant, if it's an attractive object, the mind will grasp upon it and then start building up fantasies, imaginary constructions. It could even be an unpleasant object. Again, the mind will build up imaginary constructions. These are the papancha, the mental proliferations. And they build up on the basis of this constant flowing in of different mental objects. And so using mindfulness and awareness, when any object comes into the mind, one just recognizes it for what it is and lets it go by. Of course, if one has to think about a particular project, then one allows these mind objects to come in. And of course, one uses them skillfully and effectively to serve one's purpose. But one doesn't let oneself become the victim of the random play of the mental process. But one becomes the guardian of one's own mind, the master of the processes of thought, not drifting along with the flow of thoughts. Okay, maybe at this point I'll stop and then ask whether there's any questions. Please don't be hesitant to ask. Okay, George.
On the knowledge of form, yeah. Focusing on what's the purpose or the benefit of that?
the benefit of understanding form in terms of the four elements? Okay, within the, let's go back and say, within the framework of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha says the noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. Remember in the first discourse of the Buddha, he says, this is the noble truth of suffering, then this noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. And so, what does it mean to fully understand the noble truth of suffering? It means to understand the five aggregates. And to understand the five aggregates, one generally begins with the aggregate of material form. And so, what does it mean to understand the aggregate of material form? There are different stages of understanding. The commentators divide the process of understanding into three sub-stages. Okay, now what usually happens is that first we grasp upon our sense of personal identity as being a whole, a totality. And on this, because we grasp upon our individual identity as being a solid, concrete whole, this is the basis for the view of self. So we take our own bodily, mental experience, and it appears to be a solid whole. And then because of that, grasping upon the idea of the solid whole, then we say, this is I, this is what I am, this is myself. So this is the view of self building up upon the basis of this grasping of the whole. So to dispel this grasping of the whole, what the Buddha does is to differentiate, to analyze and differentiate the basis of that grasping. And what is the basis of that grasping? The five aggregates. So when the Buddha takes the individual personal identity, then distinguishes it into form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, this gives a hard blow to the tendency to grasp the whole. Because when you're grasping the whole as myself, now one could ask, what is it that you're grasping? It's either form, feeling, perception, the mental formations, or consciousness. Okay, so now one breaks the person into the five aggregates. But now to understand the five aggregates more deeply, one has to take each aggregate and break it into its constituents. And so one takes the form aggregate. Okay, somebody might then, after you analyze the five aggregates, then somebody might grasp the body and say, this is myself. Somebody might grasp feeling and say, this is myself, similarly with the other three aggregates. And so now, to knock away that tendency to grasp one or another component as the self, one takes the form aggregate and distinguishes the form aggregate into four primary elements and then the derived material form. And so, in the first stage of understanding, one understands the constituents of each aggregate. One takes the form aggregate, breaks it into its constituents, then one moves on to the feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, mental formations, consciousness. Each of these is in turn just a label which designates a collection or which designates a number of different subordinate components. Feeling, for example, is either pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neutral feeling. or feeling arisen through the eye, through the ear, through the nose, through the tongue, through the body, through the mind. Perception, it's either perception of form, sound, smells, tastes, and so on. Okay, and so in this way one understands the aggregate in terms of its constituents. Then one moves on to the next level, which is called understanding the general characteristics. This means with respect to each aggregate, one understands or sees the three characteristics that all form, all feeling, all perception is impermanent, bound up with dissatisfaction or suffering, and is not self. And then as this insight into the three characteristics gets deeper, then it brings about the third type of understanding, which is the understanding that actually brings the removal of the wrong views of permanence, of pleasure, and of self. And when that is done, then one reaches the full understanding of the aggregate, of the five aggregates. And then it's through that full understanding of the five aggregates that one, well, one is removing the wrong views, the wrong modes of understanding, and then through that removal of the wrong modes of understanding, then all of the other defilements fall away. Okay, Peter?
Bhante, I'm struggling a little bit with the whole and part difference. And let me back up a minute. It seems like the Buddha, in general, applies what you might call reductive analysis to penetrate the reality of things.
Yeah.
And you see that in the case of discussion of rupa. And also, I think, you know, you were just talking about stopping the imagination from burgeoning as a way of keeping a grip on reality.
Yeah.
But when I think about, I was thinking about your discussion of sensual desire and analysis of the body. And it seems like sometimes properties that parts have don't necessarily translate to the whole.
Yeah.
Just a bouquet of flowers, you might look at individual petals and say, well, nothing really there, but when you put them together, wow,
yeah,
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So, and probably the Buddha wouldn't deny that.
Yeah.
But maybe the reasoning is that if you can look at the individual pieces and see that they don't have the glamour that you attribute to the whole, that may somehow mitigate the perceived attractiveness of it. But I mean, it seems to me that you could argue, well, that leg in and of itself, not a big deal. But, you know, it was like a fallacy of composition or division.
You see it on crime scene investigation.
That's right. So I guess I'm a little bit reluctant to draw the conclusion that you can't.
Okay, this is a good question. How to phrase it concisely for the recording. Okay, Peter's question or sort of qualm is that he doesn't quite go along with this idea of reductive analysis, since it's possible that even though the parts might have certain characteristics, when you put all of those parts together, it doesn't mean that the whole has that same characteristic. It's actually a good, and I would say it's a valid point, but what I would say is that this way of analyzing the body into the 32 parts, I certainly don't think it does away with the difference between, say, a stunningly beautiful Hollywood actress and then a very plain, ordinary-looking person. I mean, at the level of sense perception, that perception will still be there. But I think one should understand that particular teaching, I say, almost entirely in a strategic way. It's not even saying that in some way the disagreeableness or unattractiveness of the parts is more real than the beauty of the features, of the perceived features. But what I would say is that this is an effective strategy for removing the sensual desire. That when one sees that the object of the sensual desire, the object appears beautiful because one is perceiving the body as a whole. But especially, well, one isn't perceiving the body as a whole. One is just perceiving the surface of the body. But then when one starts looking at the individual parts, then one sees that they're not so attractive. And so it doesn't really mean that the body as a whole is not attractive, but it's just that the subjective effect is that this mode of analysis, when one develops it and cultivates it, then it causes the desire, the attraction to fade away.
And maybe an interesting follow-up to that is that if you're looking at something that is stunningly beautiful, the more you look at it, the more you see that it may not have the features that you initially attribute to it.
Yeah, that also could be true, yeah. But I'd say it's less successful than the other method. And also that method of, call it analytical perception, it's also used in relation to the opposite emotion of anger or resentment. For example, if somebody inflicts harm on you, somebody is out to create trouble for you, it's said that what you do is you can use this analysis into the five aggregates. What is it that you're angry with? Is it that person's bodily form? Well, there's no reason to be angry with the bodily form, since the form is just something, you know, physical, occupying space. It's not, the form is not really doing the harm to you. Is it the person's feelings? The feelings just arise and pass away. Is it the perceptions? Perceptions are arising and passing away. Is it the volitional formations? Of course, the real cause of the harm is in the volitional formations. But the volitional formations are just individual events arising and passing if you just use this analytical approach to look at them. So maybe 10 minutes ago somebody was trying to harm me, but now he might be looking out the window, admiring the scenery, so I can't be angry with him for some volition that he had which arose and passed away 10 minutes ago, or yesterday, or 2-3 days ago. And then his consciousness is just awareness, so I can't be angry with that. So what am I angry with? There's no point being angry with anything.
Is there three sub-stages of understanding? Is it from the commentary or is it from...
Yeah, these three stages are presented, for example, in works like Visuddhimagga. I think it's in chapter 20 or 20. I think it's in chapter 20 of Visuddhimagga, close to the beginning of the chapter. Yes?
Thank you. Can you just say a little more about the consciousness aggregate? You sort of just tacked that on the end there.
Yeah, because we've had classes where we've dealt in some more detail with the five aggregates. Okay, but the consciousness aggregate is divided into six types of consciousness. This would be eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. So it's consciousness based. The Buddha takes consciousness and then distinguishes it into six types of consciousness based on the particular sense faculty through which it arises. And the basic function of the consciousness aggregate is to know, to be aware, to experience an object through that sense faculty.
And how is that different, or how does it relate to feeling and perception?
Okay, feeling, perception, volitional formations are particular mental functions that arise in association with consciousness. So all of the five aggregates are arising together. So in any at any particular moment, all five aggregates are present together. So let's say I'm seeing the cup. So of course there's this body here, and then the eye, which is the faculty of seeing, is part of the form aggregate, material form. Okay, then based upon this eye faculty, there arises an act of eye consciousness, visual consciousness. This is the consciousness which is aware of the form, the visible form. Okay, then the feeling aggregate, this is the way I experience the object in terms of a continuum of pleasure and pain. And so if I see that this cup holds a nice refreshing drink, then there might occur pleasant feeling in a connection with that act of consciousness. If I have to drink some bitter medicine in the cup, then there might be a disagreeable feeling, unpleasant feeling. If it's just an empty cup, which is here, just somebody left it from an earlier time, then just a neutral feeling. Okay, then perception is what distinguishes, identifies the object. So it's the perception aggregate which identifies this as a cup, which would identify this as a cup of tea, or this is a cup of medicine, or whatever. Then volitional formations, that would be the factor which motivates some action in relation to the object. It could be an impulse to take up the cup in order to drink the tea. If it's just an empty cup, it could be a volition to bring the cup back to the kitchen. And then consciousness is what is aware of all of this. Okay, so that's how the five aggregates all arise together. Any further questions? Okay, if no further questions, then I have to remind you that the next class will be next Monday, not Tuesday, but Monday. And next time we'll finish this sutta and then just briefly take a look at sutta number 34. It's pretty simple, but just a few points can use a little explanation. Okay, so let us end the session with the sharing of the merits. So we dedicate the merits to the devas or Dhamma-protecting deities, the nagas or dragon spirits, the buddhas, the fear spirits, asking them to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, and to protect ourselves and others. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mangparang. Etavata cha amhehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Deva Anumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavataca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.